Our collective nightmare, the President of the United States is 79 years old, taking more aspirin than his doctors advise, and insists that the bruises on his hands are just the side effect of irritatingly thin blood. That is the official story. The rest of it is what passes for normal now. The White House doctor says the president takes 325 milligrams of aspirin a day. Independent doctors say that's higher than the commonly recommended low dose, and that it raises bleeding risk without adding benefit. The bruise on the right hand that everyone has noticed for months is now joined by new discoloration on the left, hidden sometimes with makeup, sometimes with bandages, and sometimes with his other hand doing the blocking for him. The cover-up has become choreography. A CT scan last fall was described to the press as less than an MRI, and then presented to reporters as definitive proof of a healthy heart. Records from earlier imaging showed plaque in his vessels, which was described then as moderate heart disease. The current line is perfection. Labs and scans that somehow make a 79-year-old president younger on paper and perfectly fit for command. The math does not add up. Transparency has the texture of wet paper. Doctors who actually treat heart problems point out what the public is left to guess at. Bruising like this is not usually explained by a single daily aspirin. They ask whether other medications have been omitted from the grocery list the White House put on the table. No satisfying answer has been produced. Instead came the rhetorical sweep of a promise that everything has been disclosed, delivered with the weary effectiveness of a magic trick that everyone is too tired to boo. The president says compression socks were tried and rejected for being uncomfortable. Exercise is dismissed as boring. He closes his eyes in meetings and calls it relaxation. He blames blinking photography when people say he looked like he dozed. All of this is offered as proof of normality. Normality in this version of America involves preferring convenience over caution, image over medicine, and bravado over clarity. We have arrived at a place where a nation watches a leader manage his health like a late-night infomercial. Bandages are marketed as dignity. Aspirin doses are personal preference. CT scans are theatrical proof of perfection. The public is asked to accept contradictory statements and to make peace with ambiguity dressed up as competence. This is not a report of scandal so much as a field guide to resignation. If the hand bruises are just aspirin, then let them be aspirin. If the scan is less than another scan, then less is enough. If the doctor says exceptional, and independent experts say otherwise, choose one to believe and then sleep. America has become practiced in that sleep. The rest of us will keep watching, with our eyes open enough to register the bruises, but closed enough to pretend it's nothing we can fix.
The wolf moon is coming in blazing, a literal supermoon, and apparently its only crime is being too bright. Because if there's one thing we in the developed world cannot tolerate, it's celestial bodies stealing the show from our scheduled light show. The full moon hits peak illumination at 5:03 a.m. Saturday, which means the quadranted meteor shower, the sky's polite little sparkler, shows up and the moon goes, "Excuse me," and floods the whole act with reflection. NASA and the meteor people shrug and tell you the moon will make things harder to see. The internet responds like someone just canceled brunch. Advice is practical. Face northeast with the moon at your back. Find a dark horizon. Bring binoculars if you like. Translation: rearrange your entire social calendar, move the picnic blanket 3 degrees clockwise, and take 3 dozen photos of the moon to prove you tried. Nobody needs special glasses, but of course, 6 companies are already selling moon viewing starter kits that include a blanket, a telescope, and existential regret. We're told January's full moon is called the wolf moon, named for wolves howling, or in some languages, wolves run together. Indigenous names reflect seasons and life. Our version? Hey, let's schedule a mental countdown to Artemis 2 and slap a content calendar on lunar phases. NASA politely encourages people to go out and just become awestruck. That translates, please post a tasteful, contemplative shot with the hashtag #moonthoughts. The quadrantids may only yield 5 meteors an hour under a bright moon. That's technically still something, but too few for our expectations. We don't want a celestial event. We want an experience with a timeline, an influencer-approved angle, and a weather app backup plan. Meanwhile, humans are about to fly around the moon for real. And we're worried the moon's lighting will interfere with our views of shooting stars. First world problem. The universe is too good at being photogenic.
Another night, another boat that did not make it, because counting people is easier than keeping them alive. In northwest Gambia, a vessel thought to be carrying more than 200 migrants capsized around midnight. Rescuers pulled 96 people from the water and recovered 7 bodies. The wreck was later found grounded on a sandbank. 10 survivors were in critical condition. Local fishing crews in a canoe volunteered to help alongside 3 naval speedboats and a coastal patrol vessel, the kind of ad hoc heroism that governments and agencies treat like a temporary patch. The numbers are a neat, terrible arithmetic. In 2024, more than 46,000 people reached the Canary Islands, a record, while rights groups counted over 10,000 deaths along the route, up 58% from the year before. Frontex announced a 60% fall in irregular migration along the West African route in the first 11 months of 2025, crediting stronger prevention efforts by departure countries working with EU states. Prevention, in this language, means fewer arrivals. It does not mean safer seas. It means fewer bodies registered on European soil and more bodies floating where counting is harder. This is not an accident. It is policy by consequence. Tighten one door, watch people scramble through another that is narrower and more lethal. August 2025's capsize off Gambia killed at least 70. Now another night adds to a list that grows as policy shifts blame, not responsibility. We keep a ledger of arrivals, a separate ledger of deaths, and a third for policy indicators. The sea keeps its own records. The volunteers in a fishing canoe know the difference between life and numbers. The rest prefer statistics.
From the provided article titled You Are Not Alone, Anderson Cooper talks grief on New Year's Eve, which oddly mostly lists the ways a video ad can fail, we get a perfect tiny parable of modern consolation. Anderson Cooper offers the line we keep leaning on, you are not alone. It's meant to stitch two people together across loss, across midnight, across a television screen. The promise is simple and human. Someone else notices the gap. Someone else remembers. But then the ad freezes. The video never loads. The audio is too loud. The content never starts. The comforting voice stutters into silence or blares and then disappears. Technology interrupts tenderness the way life interrupts plans, with timing that has no sympathy committee. Maybe that's the point. We reach for rituals, ball drops, anchors on camera, sentimental phrases, to smooth the jagged edges of being alive, and media provides both the ritual and the obstacle. We are invited into communal grief, but the invitation arrives as a file that might not play. What feels absurd isn't that the ad glitches. It's that we accept this setup as normal. We expect comfort to be delivered through something that can be muted, frozen, or canceled. We expect permanence from a broadcast that exists for a few seconds between commercial breaks. We expect the answer to solitude to survive the next buffering wheel. There's a small honesty in the mismatch. Grief is messy and unpredictable. Consolation arrives imperfectly. The fact that the message "you are not alone" can be swallowed by a tech error reminds us that human connection is as fragile as any signal. It also suggests the opposite. If a canned sentiment survives despite the ad problems, if the line lands at all, then maybe the form doesn't matter as much as the fact that someone tried. And so, on New Year's Eve, we gather to mark time and loss, and we trust a voice in a headset to remind us we belong to one another. Sometimes the voice fails, sometimes it is louder than necessary, sometimes it never begins. We keep watching anyway, we keep speaking anyway. The absurdity is not in the failure, but in our stubborn hope that words can hold weight against silence. If nothing else, the advertisement errors are honest. Life has bugs. It crashes. It buffers. You are still not alone, unless the audio is muted, in which case you might at least be at peace.
The capitalist fever dream, a tariff on spaghetti, the newest ritual in a religion where profit is the only sacrament. The Commerce Department flirted with a 92% duty on Italian pasta, a number that would have pushed the total levy to 107% when added to existing EU minimums. The figure read like a ransom note. A tax designed not to regulate trade, but to sterilize competition. Now the same department quietly trims the demand to 24 to 29%, citing additional comments and a show of cooperative paperwork. The theater of bureaucracy masks the real script, corporate actors demanding protection, while regulators improvise to avoid public embarrassment. This is not about sauce or heritage. 2 Midwestern firms filed an anti-dumping complaint, and the apparatus responded, sniffing for underpriced noodles like hounds for contraband. The preliminary findings singled out La Molasana and Pastificio Lucio Garofalo for sales at less than normal value, and for being uncooperative with investigators, bureaucratic euphemisms that sound like verdicts in a system built to be gamed. The Italian government's relief at a reduced tariff reads like gratitude to a system that almost crushed its exporters for political calories. Tariffs are advertised as shields for domestic industry, but they function more often as levers for rent extraction, a way to convert market friction into guaranteed margins. Companies that cannot compete on efficiency or taste weaponize regulation, and the state obligingly polishes the blade. Consumers pay with higher prices, or just as often, with the normalization of absurdity. Entire policy fights staged over bags of flour and water, because America's supply chains are less an economic network than a war room scoreboard. This episode is a symptom. When trade becomes litigation and food becomes a battleground, the economy has been hollowed into theater and rent-seeking. Institutions bend and bargain, not to steward markets, but to adjudicate which corporate player gets to skim more off the top. The calendar ticks toward March 12th for a final ruling, as if a deadline could lend virtue to what is essentially a negotiation over who gets to charge more for dinner. Meanwhile, supermarket shelves look the same. The madness is paperwork and policy, obscured beneath labels and recipes. The real product being traded is certainty, the certainty of profit in a system that rewards the loudest complaint and penalizes the cheapest offering.